Welcome to the A-Level Religious Studies Revision Podcast. I'm your tutor today, and in the next 10 minutes, we're going to cover everything you need to know about religious life and practices, specifically baptism and Holy Communion, for your EdExcel A-Level exam. Whether you're revising for the first time or doing a final polish before the big day, stay with me because this topic is absolutely packed with marks. Let's start with why this topic matters. Baptism and Holy Communion sit at the very heart of Christian practice, and EdExcel wants you to go way beyond describing what happens in a service. They want theological analysis. They want you to interrogate the relationship between ritual and salvation, what theologians call soteriology. They want you to evaluate competing scholarly positions and reach a sustained, well-argued conclusion. So let's build that toolkit right now. Part 1. Holy Communion, the Eucharistic Debate. The central question in Holy Communion is deceptively simple. What actually happens to the bread and wine? But the answers theologians have given are anything but simple, and the differences between them carry enormous theological weight. Let's start with the Catholic position, transubstantiation. This was formally defined at the Fourth Lateran Council in 1215, and later reaffirmed at the Council of Trent in 1551. The doctrine states that during the Mass, the entire substance of the bread and wine is converted into the body and blood of Christ, while the outward appearances, what Aristotelian philosophy calls the accidents, remain unchanged. So the bread still looks, feels, and tastes like bread, but its inner reality, its substance, has become Christ. This is sacramental realism at its most absolute. The Eucharist is not a symbol, it is not a reminder, it is Christ, really and truly present. Now here's where it gets interesting for your exam. Luther agreed that Christ was really present, but he rejected the Aristotelian framework of substance and accidents as philosophically unnecessary. His alternative, often called consubstantiation, though Luther himself never used that word, holds that Christ's body and blood are present in, with, and under the bread and wine. The substance of the bread remains, it doesn't disappear, but Christ is genuinely there alongside it. Think of it like iron heated in fire. The iron remains iron, but the fire is truly present within it. Luther's position is still sacramental realism, but it's a different mechanism from Rome's. This distinction matters enormously for your exam. Candidates frequently conflate these two positions, and examiners will not award marks for responses that treat them as identical. The key difference is this. In transubstantiation, the bread ceases to be bread. In Luther's view, it remains bread, but Christ is truly present alongside it. Now we move to the Marburg Colloquy of 1529, one of the most dramatic theological debates in Reformation history. Luther and Zwingli met face to face to try to resolve their differences on the Eucharist. Zwingli held a radically different view, memorialism. For Zwingli, the bread and wine are purely symbolic. They are commemorative acts, a memorial of Christ's sacrifice, nothing more. When Christ said, "This is my body," Zwingli argued the word "is" means signifies. Christ is not physically or substantially present in the elements. The Eucharist is an act of remembrance by the gathered community. Luther was so appalled by this view that he reportedly wrote "Hoc et corpus meum," "This is my body," on the table in chalk, refusing to budge. The colloquy failed. The Reformation remained divided. Between these two poles, we have John Calvin's position, a spiritual or virtualist real presence. Calvin rejected both transubstantiation and memorialism. For Calvin, Christ is genuinely present in the Eucharist, but spiritually through the action of the Holy Spirit. The faithful believer truly receives Christ, but this reception is spiritual and dependent on faith. This is a middle path that many Reformed traditions have followed. Then there is Edward Schillebeck, the 20th century Catholic theologian whose theory of transignification offers a fascinating modern alternative. Rather than focusing on a metaphysical change in substance, Schillebeck argues that the meaning and significance of the bread and wine are transformed by the community's faith and by Christ's action. The elements become signs of Christ's presence, not because their physical substance changes, but because their relational and communal significance is transformed. This is a phenomenological rather than Aristotelian account of the real presence. It's worth noting that the Vatican has been cautious about transignification, concerned it reduces the Eucharist to a merely human act of meaning-making. Part 2. Baptism. Infant versus believer's baptism. Now let's turn to baptism and the central theological fault line. Should infants be baptized, or only those who can make a personal confession of faith? The case for infant baptism, pedobaptism, rests on several theological foundations. Augustine of Hippo, writing in the 4th and 5th centuries, argued that all human beings are born with original sin, the inherited guilt and corruption from Adam's fall. Baptism, for Augustine, is the sacrament that removes this stain. Since infants are born with original sin, they need baptism urgently. To withhold it risks their eternal welfare. This is a strongly soteriological argument. Baptism is a means of grace that affects salvation. Luther retained infant baptism but shifted the theological emphasis. For Luther, baptism is not primarily about removing original sin, it is about God's unconditional promise of grace. The infant cannot contribute faith to the sacrament. Instead, God acts first, and faith is the response that grows throughout life. Baptism, for Luther, is the foundation of Christian identity, a promise to which the believer returns again and again throughout life. The case against infant baptism, credo baptism, or believer's baptism, was championed most radically by the Anabaptists in the 16th century. They insisted that baptism must follow a personal, conscious confession of faith. To baptize an infant who cannot understand or respond is to make baptism meaningless, a mere ritual rather than a genuine encounter with God. The Anabaptists were persecuted for this view, both by Catholics and by Protestant reformers, including Luther and Zwingli. In the 20th century, the most theologically sophisticated rejection of infant baptism came from Karl Barth in his 1948 work, The Teaching of the Church Regarding Baptism. Barth argued that infant baptism is not only theologically indefensible, but actively harmful to the church. For Barth, baptism is a human response to God's prior grace. It is an act of obedience and witness, not a means of grace in itself. An infant cannot make this response. Therefore, infant baptism is, in Barth's view, a disobedient act. It confuses the divine action with the human response. This is a bold and controversial position, especially given that Barth's own reform tradition had practiced infant baptism for centuries. Part 3, the BEM document and ecumenical convergence. In 1982, the World Council of Churches produced one of the most significant ecumenical documents of the 20th century, the Baptism, Eucharist, and Ministry document, known as BEM or the Lima document. This document represents decades of dialogue between Catholic, Orthodox, Anglican, Lutheran, Reformed, and Baptist theologians, and it sought to identify areas of convergence on precisely the issues we've been discussing. On baptism, BEM affirms both infant baptism and believer's baptism as legitimate expressions of the one baptism while acknowledging the theological tensions between them. It calls for mutual recognition of baptism across denominations, a significant ecumenical step. On the Eucharist, BEM describes the Lord's Supper as a memorial, but crucially, it uses the Greek word anamnesis, which is far richer than mere remembrance. Anamnesis is a representation of the past event, making it present and effective now. This language was carefully chosen to bridge the gap between sacramental realists and memorialists. For your exam, BEM is important because it demonstrates that ecumenical convergence is possible, but also that deep theological differences remain. Candidates who can engage critically with BEM, rather than simply describing it as a success story, will access the higher mark bands. Part 4. Exam tips and common mistakes. Now let's talk about how to turn this knowledge into marks. First, the AO1 to AO2 ratio. For 30 mark essays on EdExcel, the weighting is 10 marks for AO1, knowledge and understanding, and 20 marks for AO2, analysis and evaluation. This means your essay must be primarily evaluative. You cannot simply describe what Luther believed and what Zwingli believed. You must evaluate. Whose position is more theologically coherent? Whose account best honors the scriptural evidence? Whose view has the most significant implications for Christian practice? Second, the most common mistake I see is conflating Catholic transubstantiation with Lutheran consubstantiation. These are distinct positions. Transubstantiation involves the annihilation of the bread substance. Luther's view retains the bread substance. If you blur this distinction, you will lose marks. Third, for section C, the anthology question, you must engage critically with the source text, not merely summarize it. If the text is from Barth's 1948 work, you must identify Barth's specific argument, explain its theological basis, and then offer a counter-critique. Perhaps you argue that Barth's sharp distinction between divine action and human response is too rigid, that the Catholic tradition's understanding of sacramental causality offers a more integrated account. Whatever your position, it must be argued, not asserted. Fourth, Use the conclusion-first planning method. Before you write a single word of your essay, decide your conclusion. What is your overall judgment? Then build your argument to sustain that conclusion throughout. Examiners reward sustained, coherent argument, not a conclusion that appears only in the final paragraph. Part 5, Quickfire Recall Quiz. Let's test your recall. I'll ask a question, pause the podcast, think of your answer, then press play to hear the key points. Question 1. What is the difference between transubstantiation and consubstantiation? Pause now. Key points. Transubstantiation, defined at Fourth Lateran Council 1215, the substance of bread and wine is entirely converted into Christ's body and blood. Consubstantiation, Luther's view. Christ's body and blood are present in, with, and under the bread and wine, which retain their own substance. Question 2. What was Karl Barth's argument against infant baptism in 1948? Pause now. Key points. Barth argued baptism is a human response to God's prior grace, not a means of grace itself. An infant cannot make this response. Therefore, infant baptism is theologically indefensible and disobedient. Question 3. What does BEM stand for? When was it produced and by whom? Pause now. Key points: baptism, Eucharist, and ministry. Produced in 1982 by the World Council of Churches, also known as the Lima Document. Question 4. What is transignification and who proposed it? Pause now. Key points: Edward Schillebeck. The theory that the significance and meaning of the bread and wine are transformed by the community's faith in Christ's action. A phenomenological rather than metaphysical account of real presence. Summary and sign-off. Let's bring it all together. This topic is fundamentally about the relationship between ritual and salvation. Does baptism cause grace or respond to it? Does the Eucharist contain Christ or commemorate him? These are not abstract questions. They have divided Christianity for centuries and continue to shape ecumenical dialogue today. The scholars you must know are Augustine and Luther for infant baptism, Barth and the Anabaptists against it, for the Eucharist, the Fourth Lateran Council and Trent for transubstantiation, Luther for his real presence, Zwingli for memorialism, and the Marburg Colloquy of 1529 as the dramatic confrontation between them, Schillebeck for transignification, and the 1982 BEM document for ecumenical convergence. In your exam, use these scholars as active interlocutors, not just name drops. Show that you understand what they argued, why they argued it, and what the implications are. That's how you access the top mark bands. Good luck with your revision. You've got this.